now Romans chapter 13 and looking at verse 8. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. As you know, much is made of the world's debt and of a nation's debts, and how many trillions the world owes, how many hearts are troubled because of debts incurred. Yet a Christian, in one regard, according to the apostle, is always to be in debt. We should remove all financial debts, if at all possible. Stay clear of them. The psalmist tells us to lend and not borrow even, inasmuch as that's possible. Here's a testimony and a witness to the world through our generosity, through our giving, if you like. That's to be an evidence of a changed heart. Man is by nature very selfish, very self-centered. We by nature do not like to part with what we have. We are takers, perhaps, for the most part. But when we are converted, we are to become like our giving God, a giving Christ, a generous Christ. Give, don't look in return, said Christ. When you have a dinner party, as it were, he said, don't invite your friends and all that will reciprocate. Bring in the poor. Well, these are evangelistic opportunities, no doubt. But it is an aspect of the Christian life. Free as much as possible from debts that we can actually give. And look, one debt that we are always to have, according to verse 8, is to love one another. Owe no man anything in as much as it's possible, but to love one another. So that is the Christian debt. The worldling lives in a world of selfishness and greed, but believers' hearts have been changed, and here is one glorious evidence of it. We're told why we owe this debt of love to one another. For actually, look, verse 8, he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. Now, isn't that something? We often set in opposition love, grace, and the law. Well, of course, with regards to salvation, that's true. You're not saved by the law and the keeping of the law. We're saved by grace. The reason, of course, we can't fully keep the law. That's an impossibility for us. But the law and grace and love are not opponents. Indeed, they're complementary. You can't truly have one without the other. Why then is the law so despised? Why is it that we fight it? Well, because we're fallen. Because we have a corrupted nature. Because we are in opposition to God and His will. Because we are deformed. We have a bias to breaking the law. That's why. But love itself is the fulfillment of the law. The law must then be holy and just and good, as Paul declares it in Romans to be. It isn't in opposition to love. It's not that you've got to choose one or the other. No, you cannot truly have the one without the other. Love blesses others, verse 10. Look. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. Put that another way. The law then, which inspires and its fulfillment is love, motivated by love, produces love, must again be a blessing to the world, not a curse, not something to be viewed negative, not something to be opposed and despised as it often is. That shows our sinful condition. Of course, that's one aspect of the law now. It is a schoolmaster to bring you and I to Jesus Christ for salvation and reconciliation and acceptance with God. For it's the law that exposes our rebellion and our opposition to Him. Law is wholesome. The law is good. A converted soul rejoices in the law. Does not fight with the laws of God. I hope then you're seeking, because you love the Lord, to conform to the law, to conform to His will, His ways, that's of supreme importance to you and me. Not myself, Lord, but you. No, love's range and measure. Love thy neighbor as thyself, verse 9. Love is a marvelous thing, but it cannot exist apart from the law. For love is not merely a feeling. Love is doing. Love is action. Love, the law then, is not burdensome and a heavy load. No, we need it. To this day, you know, I remember being taken in my first year at the secondary school. And one of the things I was most looking forward to about the new school was the fact they had various sports teams. And I loved all kinds of sport. And of course I would be introduced to sports we didn't play in the primary school. And I remember the first day, or the first time, it was a games period. This is when you would stay after school, and the seasonal sport that was being played then, whether it was rugby or hockey, you were taken for that game. And I remember the first games period, we were given this chart with all the various classes, you know, your little schedule and program for the week. Maths and physics and everything. And you quickly looked past that and thought, when's the PE? Where's the games? Where's the sport? At least I did. And then the first games period come. And we were all taken, and I was expecting to go to the changing rooms. But where did they take us? Well, into where the assembly was held, like an amphitheater. And we were sat down, the whole year of us, and we were sat down, and we were going to play hockey. It was hockey season. And what happened? For that whole games period. Oh, I can remember how frustrated I felt and how I sat there thinking, when do we get a hockey stick? Because all he did, the PE teacher, he took us through the game. He told us what the rules were. He used terms like bully off. Now, you don't bully off in hockey anymore. You hit off or something. Then it was called bully off, and bully meant something different. He taught us what sticks were. Sticks, you lift your stick too high. That was a penalty. Told us what feet meant. They would shout feet if the ball hit against your leg or your foot. Free hit to the other team. I didn't want to learn that. I wanted the hockey stick and a ball, and let's get swinging. But imagine going out to play hockey without rules. See, that's what made the hockey, actually, when we got to playing it, all the more enjoyable. It was marvelous. Because when the other team did something wrong, you knew how to shout to the referee. Sticks! Feet! Short corner, penalty corner, ref. Come on. See, laws are good. Laws are important. You just got anarchy without law. How can you love without the law? Whenever the law tells you and gives you the parameters for love, and the law explains what you'll do. And you see Paul's examples. He takes the second table of God's law concerning interrelationships between men, between ourselves. And look, verse 9, he said, owe no man anything but to love one another. To do that, you're going to need God's law. Love the law. Love is the fulfillment of the law. You'll truly demonstrate love. For look, verse 9, for this, or take these. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it's briefly comprehended or included in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Where does the law take you? What is the fulfillment of the law? Love. And what is love? And what measure of love? Love thy neighbor as thyself. Oh, how good is the law of God. How good to have a heart that's changed, transformed, that embraces the law of God and his righteousness and his goodness. The world wants to reject God and his law, and it thinks then it can produce harmony and union and peace. Isn't that one of the greatest jokes you could ever be told? Our world is falling apart. Do you know it's only the mercy and grace of God that prevents 100 wars over and over and over? The law, if it's lived in any form, followed in any way, is what protects us, is what keeps us. The more we love it and the more we pursue obedience to it, the fulfilling of that is the loving of one another. Yes, love is the fulfillment of the law. Verse 10 sums it simply, love worketh no ill to his neighbor. What a blessing. And it's the law that is love is the fulfillment of the law. How these work together and harmonize and cannot exist apart. Well, to verse 11. Then knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. We have all sorts of instruments, all sorts of gauges that can measure processes, can measure, predict the outcome of certain events and processes and so on. Constantly used in industry. We had one chap at the church here quite a few years ago, and one very responsible part of his job was to go as a diver And I don't mean with a nice snorkel and these little things on your back, but I mean the whole weighty, crazy gear, the weighted boots and everything that kept you on the bed of the ocean, because he was assessing the oil pipes. He was, if not an expert in corrosion, something along those lines. And it was his job to assess how long they could keep using this without replacing the pipes that were under the sea. He had various instruments, no doubt, and formula and ways of calculating, but that was his particular job. Well, man has instruments and does this in all sorts of ways, the various stages, measuring things. When it started, how long it will endure or continue for. But look, do you know the time? Are you aware, friends, of the time? Paul says, verse 11, and that knowing the time. What time do you think it is in the world's history? Where are you and I in the history of the world? Paul would have Christians always have their eyes fixed and always be conscious that soon the world will end, that the world has an end date to it. Now, he's doing this 2,000 years ago. So you might be tempted to think, well, when he says, knowing the time, that now it's high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. What's he speaking of? The end of the world? The coming again of Christ? Well, yes. But what he also has and assumes, as it were, is that you'll see, even if you're not around for that, even if you don't live to see that day, and you may be convincing yourself as an unsaved person, well, it doesn't look likely, it doesn't look as if Christ is coming soon, if what I know about other signs and things to occur and happen, I don't really see it happening. And actually, when Paul wrote this to the people of his day, the night is far spent, the day is at hand. We've run 2,000 years since then. So what's the relevance? Well, it's obvious, is it not? He's pointing to that great final day to which the world is moving inexorably, unstoppably towards that day of God's appointment. But you and I within it have but a little time. We think about that day, but knowing that if and when I cease and the day has not come, there is nothing between the end of my life and that coming that I can do, however long it might be, to affect any change in my circumstances and in my character and nature. It must be in this time, keeping my eye fixed on the end of the world and the coming of Christ, but knowing I may not live to see that, but I must prepare for it. And I only have my little lifespan within the movement towards that time. This is what Paul means. Do you know the time? Do you know there is a time? The world is going to end. Not on the calculations of men. Not when they think they can see that huge big meteor that's going to wipe us out. And they'll be on the lookout. Christ will come in the twinkling of an eye. Nothing's going to detect that. Nothing's going to see him come from afar. even faster than the speed of light. He's just going to be there. The trumpet call will sound, and people's eyes will be lifted up, and they'll see him. Knowing the time. Christian friend, do you know the time? What time you've got for the Lord? It's very short. Very brief. The night, look, verse 12, is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Verse 11, latter part, now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. And of course that's so true. How much of your saved life has gone, you do not know. But know this, if you were converted 30 years ago, you're 30 years closer, with perhaps not much time to go before you depart, before you go out as that disembodied spirit into the Hades, as it's termed, paradise for the believer. Well then, Paul says, let such a teaching, such a doctrine, inspire you to certain things. And I'm just quickly mentioning them. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. There are two sides, two parts to spiritual defenses for the Christian. And often we zero in on the one, and this is what fools the unconverted, by and large. They understand the first part. That is the casting off the works of darkness. Let me just take a moment to appeal to you if you're not a Christian, and you're used to hearing preaching, read the Bible, taught the things of God, are familiar with them. By and large, avoid the great evils, the perverse, the grossly perverse and corrupted pleasures, lusts of the world. You avoid those things. You can easily be tempted to think, I'm not in that category. What do I have to cast off? I'm living a pretty good, upright, clean, moral life with regards to the external perverse things. Well, let's grant you that as part of the discussion or argument just now. What about the second part of spiritual defense? You're doing well in that you have cast off, indeed you've never engaged perhaps in the most grossly perverse things. At least in your own estimation and externally you haven't. What about the next part? And if you fail in the next part, the first wouldn't help you. You see, Paul says two parts to spiritual defense, spiritual growth, spiritual development. Cast off the works of darkness. People go that profess Christ. I don't engage in those works of darkness. But many of them have absolutely no interest in putting on the armor of light. Now, are you working at putting on as well as the casting off? How interested in holiness and righteousness are you? For this truly identifies the believer. Paul says to the Christian, you need a motive to sanctified living and the pursuit of holiness. Remember, the day is approaching. It is appointed. It's coming, and it may be soon, but it doesn't really matter in one sense. Keep your eye on it. But remember, you may only have this to live. If it's way out there, you still have only this part. And then when you depart this world, you're fixed. Your state is fixed. Your moral condition is fixed. So then, knowing the time, that now it's high time to awake out of sleep. Have you fallen asleep? Are you lethargic? Are you dozing? Are things encroaching back into the life again? That's what happens when you're unconscious or asleep. You can't resist anything. The day's far spent. The night, is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness. Well, we'll maybe develop that just a second. But look, and let us put on the armor of light. Well, what is that? Well, Paul puts it slightly differently to help us, if you like, in verse 14. Putting on the armor of light is to be putting on, verse 14, the Lord Jesus Christ. Conformity to Christ. The graces of Christ. The virtues of Christ. That's what we're to put on. That's what we're to strive for. Is there striving for? Don't just be contented and think, I avoid the worst of the world's wicked practices, delights, lusts, and pleasures. I'm free of all those. But are you putting on? What are you putting on? Christ-likeness. Virtues and graces of Christ. In the end of verse 14, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. You know, these two verses, 13 and 14, they played a remarkable part in the life of Augustine. He found in them the confidence his doubting soul was searching for. Augustine, one of the great theologians of the church, ranked perhaps alongside the like of Calvin, lived a rather immoral life as a young man. And when he was converted, he suffered greatly from doubts about his salvation. He would waken up and he was wrestling, he was struggling with doubts. He read this passage, and verses 13 and 14 brought him to say this: it was as though the light of confidence flooded my heart, and all the darkness of doubt was dispelled. Now, it may not be like that for everybody. This was what it was like for Augustine when he read these two verses. Why and what brought him the confidence that he says flooded his heart, the light of confidence flooded my heart, and all the darkness of doubt was dispelled. Well, because he could see himself in the two verses. He could see he was walking, seeking to, imperfectly, but seeking to walk honestly, or in the margin, decently. Someone has translated it properly. As in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying. Now he saw the great change that had come about in his life. He knew it was beyond him and his own power to resist certain lusts. He was almost mastered by sexual immorality. The term chambering here fits what happens so common in our day. Chambering means quite literally bed hopping. Room to room. Casual relationships and encounters and serial partners and so on. Now the young Augustine was converted. He wanted to be holy. He wanted to treat women right. He wanted to be pure in his own life. He desired holiness and righteousness. He could see in great measure how God had changed his nature. How God took those lusts and desires out of him and gave him new ones. And he was seeking to walk honestly. He was in effect pursuing holiness. He wasn't living in rioting and drunkenness. That's just partying, revelries, orgies, all that goes with the binge drinking society of our own time. The discos, the dances, the drink, the recreational drug. Hey, try this. Just walk through any of our towns, any weekend. See them fall over, young women. Not all from the sink estates, educated. Well brought up. But partying, that's what you do. Well, you see, Augustine had his fill of that. And the Lord changed his nature and his desires. And he was pursuing holiness and righteousness, cleanliness of body and soul. He said, I could see it. I read these. No longer in rioting and drunkenness, chambering and wantonness, pursuits, desires, excesses, that's what wantonness is. Unrestrained excesses. But look also, not in strife and envy. I don't know if this applied to Augustine, but maybe he was a rather argumentative, belligerent individual who loved to scrap and fight verbally all the time. Used to say back home he could start a row in an empty house. Well, maybe he saw that go too. At least he was praying against it. He not only saw the externally obvious gross sins, he could see into his heart. That's an evidence of the work of the Spirit. When you start looking at attitude and what's inside, and the thoughts and the mindset and desires and so on. Not just external practices and habits and things you engage in. This is when you know the Spirit's at work. When you're saying, Lord, change me inside. Help me in these things. That's what it is to put on the Lord Jesus Christ. Why did they wash the insides of the sacrifices? Back in Leviticus, and were given the various sacrifices. Why, when they had cut one open and they had it spread, were they to wash them? To show purity within. Christ wasn't only pure in everything that you could see. He was perfect in mind, in thought, in attitude, in mindset. How beautiful. If we're putting on the Lord Jesus Christ, that's what we're seeking. That's what we crave. That's what we desire. Put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ. And look, make not provision for the flesh. We keep leaving the little door ajar. You know, so we can allow ourselves a little indulgence here and there. Whatever it might be, probably won't take too much thinking on your own part to think, yeah, I do. I toy with that. I suppress it most of the time, but I just allow myself a little indulgence. Be extremely careful. Sin lieth at the door. He'll kick the door in. Don't allow the least. Pray against it. Pray for sanctification. Pray for mortification of sin. Not to have it three quarters dead. It has remarkable recovery power. It'll spring up again. It'll take your life over. If the Spirit of God doesn't suppress, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh. Oh, I can watch a little something. I know the rating isn't particularly what it should be for a Christian. It's a bit high. There's got to be something dodgy in here, but I can watch it. I can control it. I can have a little sip. I can have a little drink. I can have the odd party. I can go out with the girls, out with the boys. I can make no provision for the flesh. I can indulge in a little covetousness. I can indulge in a little self-satisfaction. I can indulge in the missing of a few meetings and things. And I don't have to be here. I don't have to be there. Watch. Just watch. It'll creep up and up and up. That's the way it works. That's why Paul doesn't say, allow yourself a little bit. You know, it's hard. It's tough. Let yourself go. Let your hair down. Sometimes. Make not provision for the flesh. You feed it and it's getting stronger. It's growing. And soon it'll have you in a grip you can't break free of. Only the grace of God keeps us. So let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not even in strife and envying, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Love the law. The fulfillment of the law is love. The law takes you there. The law is wholesome. It is pure. It is good. Rejoice in it. How love I thy law, said David. It is my meditation day and night. For it's Christ. It's Christ-likeness. And remember, the night is far spent. Christian, if you're intending to make correction, adaptation, change, introduce something for the Lord, do it now. The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Your day, my day, may soon be over. But that day is appointed, and it's approaching, and it's coming. At least we can say this. It's 2,000 years closer than when Paul wrote the words. And your own personal departure is how many years since you first believed? Isn't your salvation nearer than when you believed? Now's the time then to give to the Lord.